So, we were reviewing the Bodhisattva vows, and we finished the review of the 18 root. Actually, we finished a review of the whole path up until now. And so we're going on to the 46 auxiliary paths. And so again, you know, to remember that the guidelines set forth in these vows are not commandments. They're things that we undertake voluntarily, and we undertake them with an awareness that we can't keep them perfectly, because if we could keep them perfectly, Buddha wouldn't have needed to set them out. Yeah? So also an awareness that these are pointing out very specific things that can really act as a guideline in our daily life to make us more mindful. Okay, so not mindful in the sense of being paranoid of doing something wrong, but just mindful of what our real heartfelt values are and how we want to live, and so thus mindful of what's going on in the situation, including what we're thinking and feeling and saying and doing, so that we can make wise choices in our life instead of, you know, just being on automatic and not making the choices that present themselves to us in our life. Okay. And so the whole thing in the vows, it's in order to live ethically, we have to know what the unethical actions are, and so then we know to abandon those, and then we know to do the opposite. So in hearing all these different things, you know, to abandon this and abandon that, it's again, you know, it's not take. Don't do that, else you're bad. It's just saying, you know, if we want to live an ethical life, be really aware of those things and how we get involved in them, and then make a choice when those situations arise not to do that. And then look at what the opposite of those actions are, and then you can really see some things that you can choose to get involved and engaged in. Okay? So that's kind of the scope in which the Bodhisattva vows are set out. And like I said, the Bodhisattva vows are really focusing on helping us put into practice our wish to free ourselves from all the disadvantages of the self-centeredness, and our wish to reap all the advantages for self and others of cherishing others. So these 46 auxiliary Bodhisattva precepts are broken down into different groups. Okay? So they're basically in seven groups. Six of the groups are according to the six far-reaching attitudes, and then the seventh group are specifically referring to the ethics of benefiting sentient beings and, you know, going into that. So if you look in Pearl of Wisdom Book 2 on page 62, you know, you can start seeing the different clumps of the Bodhisattva vows. So the first seven have to do with the far-reaching attitude of generosity. 8 through 16 have to do with ethics. Okay. 17 through 20 with patience, 21 through 23 with joyous effort, 24 through 26, meditative stabilization, 27 to 34 with wisdom, and then 35 to 46 is the ethics of benefiting others. Okay, so it's kind of categorized in groups that make it easier for us to practice them. So this first group about generosity, okay, so generosity is the wish to be able to give our body, possessions, positive potential to others without any feeling of poverty, without any regret, you know, so just the wish to be able to give when it's appropriate, when the circumstance presents itself. Now, the chief obstacle to generosity, there's two of them, attachment and miserliness. So these are the two big obstacles. Attachment, which clings to the things for ourself, and miser, you know, wanting to get more things for ourself, and miserliness, which doesn't want to share what we have. Okay? So it's interesting. There's two ways to look at it. If we value generosity, you know, it's like we see generous people and we think about what it's like to be generous, and we kind of develop some aspiration towards that because we really see it seems like a wonderful thing to be able to be, then if we have that regard for generosity, then we'll see that attachment and miserliness are things that we want to counteract. On the other hand, if we look at it from the other way, and we think of, well, when I'm attachment, this and that happens, when I'm miserly, this and that happens, and we recognize all the faults of the miserliness and the attachment, and how much, you know, harm they cause to ourselves and others, then we'll wish to practice generosity because that's the antidote. Okay, so do you see you can kind of go back and forth between these two? If you want generosity, well, then of course I have to give up the miserliness and the attachment. And if I want to give up the miserliness and attachment because that makes me miserable, then of course I have to practice generosity. You know? So you really kind of, you can approach it from both wings that way. Okay, so the first guideline here is to avoid not making daily offerings with body, speech, and mind to the triple gem. Okay? Now, our mind might say, oh, this sounds like, you know, I have to, you know, do all these nice things for the triple gem, otherwise I'm going to get punished and sent to hell. Hmm? That's what, you know, person who grew up in Christian environments that thinks, you know, immediate thought. You know, oh, I gotta do this because otherwise, you know what happened. That's not what it's talking about, okay? It's coming from this viewpoint of if we admire generosity and we want to develop it, and we really see how miserliness and attachment makes us miserable, we want to get rid of it, well, the easiest way to practice generosity is with the triple gem. Because they have so many good qualities that our heart gets very pleased and wants to make offering. So it's very good to practice becoming generous with the triple gem because in one way it's easier because we see their good qualities. You know, sometimes it's harder to practice generosity with people that we don't like because we can always fudge our way out of it by saying, well, they're so rude and nasty. Why should I do anything for them? You know, but we can't do that with the triple gem. Yeah, because kind of their kindness to us is there. So, you know, somehow it's easier for us to be generous that way. And again, they don't need it at all. So, you know, we can really see that the offerings that way are done really, you know, for our own cultivation. Now, what does it mean to offer with the body, speech, and mind? Offering with our body is, for example, like doing prostrations. And if you can't do long prostrations, you know, even just going like this, you know, even you can't do short prostrations, maybe you're sick, you can't get out of bed, you just go like this, that's okay, you know. Even you can't do that, you're really sick, you can just go like this, you know. You know, they say just lift one finger, that can be a prostration, yeah. So, you know, kind of physically, you know, showing our respect, and then verbally to offer some praise to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And so, for example, the request prayers that we do, you know, when we're talking about the kindness of our teacher and the illuminators of the path and those who have the eyes of wisdom and so on, then this is the verbal praise. Or doing the mantra, O Namo Majushya Namo Sushya Namo Tamashya Soha, when we're prostrating. That's also, you know, verbally praising the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then mentally is remembering their qualities. Okay, so again, just to mentally inside of our heart remember their qualities. And even, you know, when we're bowing or when we're offering or something like that, just to do the visualization of them, you know, and just do the visualization, remembering their kindness and their qualities. So that's mentally offering prostrations. And so if we do that, then that helps our own mind, because the more we can remember the triple gem, then the more we feel this kind of underground support in all of our actions. We don't feel like we're alone in this, you know, kind of polluted world, I'm all alone, what's going to happen? The more we remember the triple gem, you know, and making offerings helps us remember them, then the more, you know, the refuge becomes stronger, and we feel this underlying support so that whatever's going on in our life, you know, we can fall back on that refuge, we can fall back on that relationship. Okay? So that's why, you know, it's really nice, you know, if you can have a shrine in your house, And then, you know, make offerings every day. You can offer water or fruit or whatever. And, you know, in the morning when you get up, bow three times. In the evening before you go to bed, bow three times. It becomes very helpful. Okay, then the second one. Acting out selfish thoughts of desire to gain material possessions or reputation. Remember I told you that I used to kind of review these vows daily, and there were some that every night I looked at. This one. Every day. Oh, again. I transgressed that one. Okay? So, this one, I mean, it's real, because we just see how easily the mind thinks of something, and then we act it out. Mind says, I want this, and we go to the store and buy it. Yeah? Mind says, I want to do this, we go and do it. Okay? Mind says, I want to eat this, we go to the refrigerator. Yeah? Or mind says, I want praise, so I do something to put myself in a situation where I'm praised. Mind says, I feel insecure, I want a good reputation, then I, do stuff so that I get a good reputation. Yeah? So, kind of really following out this mind that's seeking, the mind of desire, that's seeking material possessions and reputation and praise. So again, that doesn't mean that we're bad people when we do that. Okay? Repeat. It does not mean we are bad people when we do that. It just means that when we notice we're doing it, it's a signal to us of, I have to reconnect with what's important in my life. I've forgotten. Okay? So instead of beating ourselves up and telling ourselves we're bad, to go back and say, hold on, I need to reconnect. What is really important in my life? You know, is it running around and making a big name for myself? Is it, stuffing my house full of stuff or stuffing my stomach full of stuff or, what is really important in my life and reconnecting with that? Okay? So that doesn't mean that we should never go out and buy stuff. Okay? Because there are things that we do need. Okay? So this is a thing of balance. Yeah, this is talking about when the mind is really full of clinging desire and doing things, just this really desiring mind. The mind that wants, it's like we feel we have a hole inside, so let's go buy something to fill up the hole, or let's go eat something to fill up the hole, or let's go talk up a storm to fill up the hole. And so it's that kind of attitude that we want to counteract. Okay? But we do need to go to the store and buy food, okay? And we do need to go to the store and buy the clothes that we need to wear when it's hot or cold or whatever, yeah? So this isn't, again, going to the extreme of saying that everything I like or everything I want is an object of attachment, okay?
Yeah, I hope that somehow it brings a
smile. Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, there are things that we do that we take pleasure in, okay? And there's nothing wrong with that pleasure, okay? And we don't want to get into this thing of, everything I like I have to deny myself of, because that's going into what I was talking about before, kind of we dissociate. We go into, extreme asceticism. But it's more just an awareness of why am I doing what I'm doing, okay? So, you still like to go out to breakfast on weekends. Well, that's great, if it gives you pleasure and you do it and you're understanding why you're doing it and you want to share that pleasure, okay? Then that's quite different than the mind that says, I really want to go and have pancakes and blah, 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 and it's like, I got to do this, and I'm going to be totally miserable on Sunday morning if I don't go out to breakfast, and I've got to do this, else I'm going to, I mean, that whole mind that just gets obsessed with something, okay? So it's this thing of, there's nothing wrong with enjoying things, but not to get so stuck on them that we have to do them and that we're going to be miserable if we can't. Yeah. And so we do things that we enjoy because we know it keeps us balanced. It keeps us, you know, we're not all Buddhists yet, and you know, it keeps us balanced. But we do those things with an awareness of trying also to make it something more than just, you know, the immediate gratification. Okay, and the awareness of, wouldn't it be nice if, you know, the people in Sarajevo could also go out to breakfast on Sunday mornings. Yeah? And, you know, some kind of charity of that feeling that we have, you know, hoping that others can have that too. Okay, then the third one, not respecting one's elders. So elders means those who have taken the bodhisattva's vows before us, or who have more experience before us, or who have, if you're an ordained monk or nun, those who were ordained before you. Okay, so the idea here is that by respecting those who are more practiced in the path than we are, it helps open us to develop their good qualities, and it also helps us to abandon our pride and arrogance. Okay, so, because pride and arrogance are also a big obstacle on the path. And sometimes we really have this fear that we're going to lose our position, or we're going to lose our dignity if we show respect to somebody else. You know, especially in American culture, it's like, I show respect to somebody else, that means I'm, you know, I'm acknowledging that they're better than me and I'm the underdog. And, how can that happen? Yeah. Whereas from a Buddhist viewpoint, you know, seeing others' qualities and acknowledging those and showing them respect is coming from a feeling of valid self-confidence and a point of internal strength. Okay, whereas we usually see it in the West as coming from weakness and lack of confidence. It's exactly the opposite. It's like apologizing to people. You know, being able to apologize is coming from a point of having good self-confidence and internal strength. Whereas defending ourselves to the very end is really coming from a point of weakness. So this regard, you know, this thing here of showing respect to elders is something that really helps us in the path. And it, you know, by developing our good qualities because we appreciate those qualities in others, and it helps free ourselves from, you know, this incredible, actually it might be part of our individualism, you know, that I have to be noticed all the time. Okay, so we don't want to show respect to others because then I won't be noticed. And if I don't make myself noticed, then what's going to happen? Who am I going to be? You know, whereas, you know, it's actually quite nice to relax and to feel I don't have to make myself noticed all the time. You know, I can be in this group and I don't have to be, you know, the big star of the group. Yeah, I can be here and, you know, and respect other people and learn from them, and I don't have to go around kind of selling myself like a product on the market, telling everybody, well, I'm so knowledgeable in this way and I know so much about that, and, you know. Okay, so this is done very much to counteract the pride and arrogance. Well, the precept here is specifically about religious elders, but I think in a general way, it's just helpful in our general relationships in society. You know, if with our boss we have a certain, you know, a certain kind of respect for their position, it doesn't mean that we think everything they do is right. You know, same way, you know, just because somebody was ordained before you doesn't mean everything they do is right. But it's kind of, you know, valuing that position or valuing what they might know because they're our boss, or what they might know because they're older than us. Yeah. Actually, I think there's a lot of wisdom to be gleaned from older people. I think it's a real tragedy in our society that we put so much emphasis on youth, because when you sit down and talk to some old people and you really get them to tell you about their life, it's so incredible. You know, just really hearing people's lives and what they've lived through and what they've gone through and how they've dealt with situations. And it's just, it's incredible. There's one woman, Grace McLeod. She's probably the oldest Buddhist in the whole community in Seattle. She's, I forget, 84, 82, 84, 86, something like that. Incredible. She doesn't live very far away from here. Incredible person, so sharp and so bright. And it's just nice to go over there and get her to tell you stories about, you know, when she was 18 years old and converted from being a Catholic to a Buddhist, and, you know, and what she went through, and you know, and just, you know, even the elders in our family, learning some of the family history and the family legends, it can help us a lot to understand things. I know for me personally, just like even in the Tibetan community, when I've listened to some of the people's stories, you know, and gotten some of the elders to tell their stories and what it was like, especially, you know, when they fled Tibet and everything like that. So it really gives me a feeling of confidence that if for some reason I find myself in that kind of horrible situation, if I can remember these people's stories, it'll keep my own spirits up, because somehow, you know, you meet some of these people and they went through absolutely incredible things, and you look at them and they're like, you know, kind of well-adjusted, happy people now. And it's just so nice to know that can happen, and that if I ever get in that situation, you know, of incredible trauma going on, if I can remember these people's stories, then it's going to help me. So I think kind of having that respect and wanting to, you know, listen to the elders and learn from them can really enrich our own lives.
Why?
Because I think it's like generosity of positive feelings, generosity of respect, generosity of praise, or, you know, reputation like that.